Welcome to the Awakened to Wholeness Summit. I'm Val Salidkar. We are about to journey into the sacred inner realms of our lives with a woman who is sometimes called the midwife of the psyche, Tokopah Turner. Tokopah is a writer, teacher, and dream worker, blending the mystical tradition of Sufism in which she was raised with a Jungian approach to dream work. She founded the Dream School in 2001, from which hundreds of students have graduated. Tokopah has a community of over 75,000 online readers. She's currently finishing a book on belonging, which explores the themes of exile, embodiment, and the search for belonging. Tokopah's work focuses on restoring the feminine, reconciling paradox, and facilitating sacred grief and ritual practice. It's so wonderful to have you with us.
Welcome. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Val. I'm really happy to be here.
It's, you know, I feel like this being with our dreams and exploring, you know, the wiseness, the wisdom that's within us is such a lost art, something that our society, especially in Western culture, does not really value. You know, we almost put it away as something that's woo-woo with all these A to Z books and things like that, you know? And it's so wonderful to have someone like you holding sacred space for us to dive into these rich realms, because they're so
Thank you. Yes, I think probably dedicating my life to being on this path came out of a similar recognition of the absence of teachers and wisdom keepers in our tradition, at least, which is to say the melting pot that is North America. And have a very deep connection to my own dreams ever since I was very small. And in the way that I was raised in the Sufi community, the focus on dreams was actually quite central. And so we would often just wake up in the morning and tell our dreams. And it didn't go much further beyond that, but just the very philosophical emphasis on paying attention to our dreams or giving relevance to our dreams. Just having that already, I was so much richer than a lot of other folks who, you know, are usually taught to dismiss their dreams or taught that dreams are just the flotsam of, you know, daily life showing itself in our nocturnal experiences. So I really felt that absence, that glaring absence, and wanting to bring something of that to my community.
So you knew from a young age that you wanted to be a dream worker, or how did that unfold for you in your life, that passion?
Well, to tell you the truth, when I first became a dream worker, that word didn't even exist. So I kind of made it up. There were a few other people who had made up that word too. But so no, I didn't know that there was even such a thing. That came much later. But I was so interested in my dreams. I used to have incredibly vivid dreams, but not only that, I seemed to have an access to different kinds of dream time experiences, things like lucidity and astral traveling. There were a lot, I had a lot fewer inhibitions around that kind of exploration in the dream time when I was young. And so I had some very mystical experiences at a very young age. And, you know, I lived in a spiritual community, so our bookshelves were filled with things like Carlos Castaneda and Hafiz and, you know, Rumi and Robert Monroe and, all, you know, Jung and all of these things. And so those were the kinds of books that I was reading when I was very small, which is really, I know that sounds really strange to be 8 or 9 years old and reading Carlos Castaneda, but I was super into it. I was a weird kid.
Yeah, beautiful. I mean, I can only imagine how that really informed your development into your teens as a young adult. And bringing all of this into your awareness at such a young age really is a sense of maturing into what's possible, maturing into the psyche at such a young age, something when we're usually out there playing in ways that are sort of jumping into society play and not really playing in ways that are enriching ourselves and maturing ourselves through adolescence and adulthood, you know?
Yeah, you know, I actually recently feel very grateful for whatever that inclination was in me to get started so young, you know, because I think I see a lot of people now who are just kind of coming into those sorts of awakenings in midlife, you know, so I was really blessed to have grown up in a community where those things were valued. But that being said, I think it's also important to say that, like many teenagers, I rebelled from that whole world for many years. And I ended up leaving home at a very young age. I was 14 when I left home. And I think it's important for me to tell that part of my story because you know, I ended up living in the system and group homes and things like that, shelters, and even sometimes spent on the streets. And during that time, because I was so estranged from my own family, my dreams became a kind of parent to me. And so looking back on it now, I think I really was raised by my dreams.
I can imagine that opened, you know, you have a blog that you write about, and you focus a lot on the sense of belonging and exile. And it, when we look at how our lives, our evolutionary lives have unfolded, you know, we've come to a place now where we've seemed to have forgotten who we are along the way. You know, our connection to ourselves, or such a disconnect in general in our society and within ourselves. And so there is this feeling of exile, of longing to belong to ourselves, to something, to the world. And I wonder if you could speak about that and how this experience of your life, being on the streets, feeling exiled, has informed your work.
Yeah, it's a big question. Thank you for your interest in that, because it is the heart of my obsession in these last few years. And so, you know, it's a very long story how I arrived at, you know, writing this book, which I should say is very close to being finished. So I should be able to release it probably in the springtime. That's my hope. But I've been at it for a few years, and because it's such a big topic, belonging is such a big topic, I've really had to go very deep on this one. And I think because of the way that I grew up and you know, my experience of being exiled from my family really makes me uniquely qualified, in the sense that not that I had a sense of belonging, but quite the opposite, that belonging was something that was so alien to me that it became sort of an obsession to me to understand, you know, what is this thing that we long for, you know, what is belonging? What does it look like when somebody achieves it or has it? And so, you know, a lot of us think of belonging as something outside of ourselves, that if we just keep diligently searching for, we're going to one day hopefully just find, and it'll be intact, and we'll recognize it instantly, and it will recognize us, and then we'll all live happily ever after in a state of belonging. But, you know, I did a lot of research in the beginning year of this book, and I started to talk to people from many different walks of life and asking them, really, you know, do you feel a sense of belonging? And if so, where, and what does it look like? But I would say 95% of the people I talked to, and even some who seemed incredibly ensconced from the outside looking in a state of belonging, didn't feel like they belonged. And so here's this nebulous idea, you know, what is this belonging? And I started to think, what if belonging isn't a place at all, but a set of skills or competencies that we in modernity have lost or forgotten? And so, as you were alluding to in your question, you know, we are a displaced people. We are, all of us. If you know, and not just obvious refugees, you know, in this and the last generations, but if you If you trace back our history, even those of European heritage, you'll find exile at the heart of most people. Most people have been exiled from their land of origin. And so that, and that travels and metastasizes through the generations, and we experience that, a very physical and fundamental level, a sense of being outside of belonging, because we've lost the ways of our people and the land to which those people belonged, and the traditions of those cultures, whatever they may be. So there's that level of belonging. But I think there are also many other levels, as I discovered, of belonging, such as not just belonging to a people and a geography, let's say, or a land, but then, of course, belonging to our own bodies, you know. Embodiment is something that is a lot of people are trying to understand and come back into, because we live in a very disembodied culture with our virtual, you know, our virtual connections and realities. But then there's an even subtler level of belonging, which is the belonging to our own selves, our belonging to our gifts and our abilities. Do we belong to them, and do they belong to us? Mm-hmm. And then we can take it even subtler and think of this belonging as this something greater to which we want to belong, which, you know, some people call source, some people call spirit, some people call Gaia consciousness, God. And for me, I just like the word nature, because there is a symbiosis between our lack of belonging at the level of body and our lack of belonging at the level of nature, the natural world, the other than human world all around us.
So
I think belonging is really the central conversation of our times, and yet it's very rarely spoken about in the open.
Absolutely. And thinking about our relationship too, you know, this sense of belonging, we can play with the word relationship. How do we relate to ourselves? How do we relate to each other? How do we know ourselves in the context of this sort of unfolding evolutionary, you know, universe story? So this cosmological way of knowing ourselves as Earth, knowing ourselves as the other than human, knowing ourselves as each other, you know, seeing ourselves within all of this. What does that mean? And how we don't really ask those questions. We just kind of go on automatic, and it's almost like we're stuck in this paradigm of separation. There's us and them, and there's just so such a chasm between ourselves with our deeper sense of self, ourselves with the other.
Yeah, which is why I really like the emphasis on belonging as a set of competencies, a set of skills that we have to develop, you know, because nobody has really taught us how to do it. And so we're a little bit elders in training, you know, and have to learn how to create a sense of belonging in our own lives, so that that can then become a shelter of inclusion for others. And then others can, in that shelter, learn how to practice that belonging themselves. But it's a lot. There's a lot to be learned there. And there's a lot of grief, too, for how much we have lost in not having those things taught to us, you know.
So true. And it shows up in so many ways in our lives, in our communities, this grief. And I know that's part also of another theme in your work, is looking at the sacred grief. Grief is sacred. How do we honor that which we feel and allow it to be sort of a gateway into our deeper knowing? So talk a little bit about that grief as sacred, and how that shows up in your work and maybe in the dream space of the people that you work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, I've had a long relationship with rehabilitating my own grief, because, you know, at that age, when I was so young and I went into the system, it was a very tough environment. It was a very dangerous place. And so in order to protect myself in, you know, being a very sensitive being in that environment, I really had to shut down my feeling. And my feeling was shut down for many, many years. And it wasn't until probably my late teens, early 20s, that I began to have spontaneous bouts of grief. I would actually wake up from sleep having had a dream that was humiliating or violent or repulsive, and I would spontaneously be weeping when I woke up. And so I had all of this unprocessed grief, which was just flooding my life after having been suppressed for so long. So it took a long time for me to come into a healthy relationship with my grief, because I was always taught when I was young, and maybe you and others can relate to being told not to cry, that it was over dramatic, or that it was seeking attention, or that it was weak. Or maybe there just wasn't something in our environment or someone in our environment to just hold presence for that, to nurture us through that process.
I'm thinking even as a child, the way that we approach children, like if they fall or if they're sad, oh no, you're okay. You're okay. You're okay. We want to mask it. We want to immediately mask it rather than just allowing them to feel what it is on any level. Physical, whatever's happening. So yes, absolutely with you in this. We numb it out, we run away, we're taught not to feel.
Yes, yeah. And so, one of my teachers, Martine Prechtel, says that violence is actually an inability with grief. Violence is an inability with grief. So in other words, our world is so filled with violence, and there is this calcified grief underneath that. And so the inference there is that grief then it has a softening effect. Right, it can soften the brittle soil of our beings in order to make it fertile for something tender to sprout, for something beautiful to come of that, those places. So grief is essential to the work of healing. It really is. It is the punchline. It's the core piece. Grief, and so a lot of dream work, because dream work goes really deep. When we're dealing with a dream, it bypasses all of the small talk and gets straight to the heart of the matter, which is why when we do dream work together, if you ever do dream work with somebody, it's an incredibly intimate process. And even if you're strangers, you can feel so deeply bonded to each other at the soul level, because that's where you're communicating and connecting. But because you're in this very tender center heart place, there's often a lot there that is the yearning to be seen, which is longing to be recognized. Mm. And so in the moment, if you can hold presence for someone in a dream, and I mean a deep sort of embodied presence, then if you can really give someone an opening into that feeling of being seen, of being recognized, grief will pour out from that place. And it is evidence that healing is taking place. And so whenever I say grief, I empathize with the pain, but I'm also so joyful because it means that healing is happening. And it's taken a long time for me to get there, but of course I went through it, and continue to go through it. It's not like there's an end to that journey, because there are, of course, deeper and deeper levels of grief. Deeper below the personal grief, there's the collective grief.
Yes, I hold that within us, that grief for the world. And I think also when we allow ourselves to be so deeply present for what it is that we're feeling, that grief that we're feeling, and recognizing it as evidence of our interconnection with life as well, it opens us up to the love that we have for the world, the love that we have for ourselves. And I think we can only really feel the depths of our love through going through the process of understanding our grief.
Well, they're the same thing. Grief and love are the same thing, actually, because you wouldn't grieve something unless you loved it so deeply. Right? Yeah. So they're two things. So they're two parts of the same thing. So when we see somebody grieving, that's why you often never have that experience. You see somebody like deeply grieving, and they're so beautiful. Their eyes are sparkling, and you just feel so alive, and your heart is filled. And I think it's because the love is so present in that moment for both parties.
Absolutely. You know, there's a beautiful ritual called the Truth Mandala. Joanna Macy has brought this into our world, and it's so powerful, and it's an invitation for us to dive into these deeper feelings, recognizing that other side of the same coin, right? The deep love that is our grief. And it's amazing how when we come into that place where we allow ourselves to truly break open in this ultimately sacred way, that we fall so much more deeply in love with ourselves. And I feel like the real conversation begins there.
Mm-hmm.
A raw, open place. Because it is, it's so raw, it's so vulnerable to allow ourselves to feel that deeply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's sometimes a temptation to back up, you know, after you've become so raw. And that's a sort of tricky passage to make. But I think if you're doing it right, you should be becoming increasingly vulnerable as you get older. And vulnerable is a tricky word, you know, because we think of it as being, like we even use it in the language, like vulnerable to outside influences, that kind of thing. But I don't really think of vulnerability this way. In fact, I've made up a new word, which I'm trying to pass around. So
pass it on. What is it?
So the word is vulnerable bravery. And so it's the idea that vulnerability is actually an act of bravery, because the more we can just take off that armor and allow ourselves to be truly seen and truly see others, then that kind of porousness that we create from that allows us to hear so many more hidden kinds of languages, not just the human languages, but languages and communications from nature, from the body, from energy fields, and so on.
Absolutely. Wow. This is the conversation that we all need to be having right now, you know, to really be diving into this. And so when you approach somebody with their dreams, with all of this, you know, open to all of this that wants to come through, what is the process for you? Like when you're working with somebody, how do you approach working with dreams?
Well, it's an incredibly simple process, actually. So if we were working on a dream, you would just tell me the story of your dream. And then I might just ask you, my intention is to try and walk inside your dream with you as if I am looking through your eyes. So a lot of the questions that I will ask you upon hearing our dream are mostly about trying to see things through your eyes. How did it feel when you made that encounter? Do you recognize that from anywhere in your life? You know, what can we get into the nuances of different interactions and spaces in the dream? And so these are just, I'll go through a series of these kinds of clarifying questions to see if I can really situate myself in an embodied place inside your dream. And then together, we just kind of walk through it piece by piece and try to bridge back what we discover in the subtlety of the dream to experiences that you might be having in waking life. And often there are correlations, not always though, because some dreams come from an unstructured place. You know, they can come from you know, transmissions which are, you know, outside of time and space. And you can usually recognize those dreams because of their tonal difference. They'll have a different sort of mystical quality, a numinous quality to them. Mm-hmm. But most of the dreams that we work with have some correlation to the things that we're facing in waking life. And so what we're trying to do really is to understand the mythic dimension of the passages that we're going through in waking life. And so this is where it really helps to have a knowledge of fairy tales and mythology, because then what we can do is track back what we happen to be going through in waking life, track back to the archetypal level, and to see ourselves as the heroes or heroines in our own stories that are going through similar unfoldments as the people that we read about in storybooks. And the benefit of making that relationship known is that that then we can know what chapter comes next, you know. So if we're in a period of great descent, and we have, you know, we're in exile and we've lost everything that's important to us, we can know that this is an initiatory period, because we read about that in fairy tales, and that the initiation periods go much faster if we give ourselves to them, and if we recognize their meaningful quality. So a lot of the dream work that I would say the intention behind dream work is really wanting to touch that place of meaningfulness, so that our lives on the surface may appear to be mundane, or that we're just going through motions. When we look at our dreams, we see that that's not so, that there's actually a much vaster intelligence which is coming through in the expression of our lives. And that's why I like to use the word nature when it comes to dreams, because I do believe that that is exactly what dreams are. It's nature, naturing through us. And there would have been a time where, you know, in and still in many indigenous cultures and Aboriginal cultures, that dreams are highly regarded and that are kept central to making decisions about our lives and to our, you know, tribal lives as well.
Yeah, and the messages that would come in those dreams from the ones holding dreams would be for the whole community.
I'm sorry, say that again?
The messages that would come into the dreams in Indigenous cultures we see often is a message that's not just a personal message, but rather one for the whole community to look
at. Exactly, exactly. And so coming back to nature, it's, you know, we start to see ourselves as part of that ecosystem, that we're part of a larger ecosystem. And that whatever is calling, whatever is longing in our lives, whatever is longing for something, whatever is calling us forward on vocation towards something, also belongs to a greater whole, which is dependent upon our unfolding in that way. And you see this really obviously when you do dream work in groups, because then what happens is over, say, a couple of days in retreat or something, dreaming together, people will start to share symbols unbeknownst to each other. Wake up in the morning and there may be 6 out of 10 people in a group who all have a similar symbol in their dream. And then it becomes very obvious that we're not like an ecosystem. It's not a metaphor. It is a thing. We are an ecosystem. And then you start to recognize and appreciate our indivisibility. And then whatever your personal mission is has so much power behind it, because you realize it's not just important for your, you know, whatever your micro personal drama might be, but it's important for the collective that you do what your duty is, you know.
Well, I wonder, like in the work that you do, are you noticing, and how long have you been doing dream work now?
Well, I started the Dream School in 2001, so yeah, about 15 years.
Okay. So in that 15 years, have you noticed, I mean, you must notice, as you're saying now, even the symbols coming up, but patterns of dreams, not necessarily in group work, but even in the individual people that you're working with, that could be sort of contributing to this more holistic message of how where we are and how we're moving forward in our world. Do we see that message coming through our dreams?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think, you know, simply put, the awakening of the feminine is probably that the broadest way that I could tell you what I see in both men and women's dreams. When I speak about the feminine, I'm not talking about gender. I'm talking about, I'm just saying this for those who don't know what I'm talking about, because often when I write about the feminine, I get people coming out of the woodwork and saying, well, I'm a man and I have dreams too, or I, you know, or whatever. Yeah. So the feminine is just a term that has been used a lot by the Jungians, and it speaks to the whole, I actually like the words yin and yang a lot better because they're a lot less charged, but the yin side of things is where what we would associate with the feminine. So the feminine is, you know, we live in a very, like you were saying earlier, a very yang-based culture, where there's a great emphasis on accomplishment and status and achievement and power, the accumulation of wealth and prestige, things like that. And so the other side, the neglected side, is about receptivity. It's about listening. It's about intuition. It's about instinctual response. Yes. It's about the feeling life. It's about dreaming.
Yeah, and we're seeing that now. Everywhere I turn, we're seeing this sort of rise of the feminine energy again, not masculine, not male, female, but this feminine, these feminine qualities, you know, are really rising. And there are a lot of women that are coming together to sort of supercharge that within ourselves.
Yeah.
So we see these red tents popping up everywhere. We see these women's circles. We see a lot of this happening now too. Women coming together to explore what that is, and men becoming open, more soft and open to that energy and bringing that in, redefining what it means to be masculine.
Yeah. Yeah. Hallelujah.
Yeah, definitely.
That's, yeah. And, you know, it also must be said that, you know, given the current state of politics in America, that we can see the opposite rearing up twice as strong. And I think, you know, there's this great old saying that that things will rear up twice as strong when they feel threatened, you know. And, you know, that's right before they retire like an old dog by the fire. You know?
Yeah, I like so, that second part too. Because it is happening. There is like this, the extreme on the spectrum is happening right now, that equal and opposite reaction, you know. So we see all of this, even I'm thinking about with Standing Rock and, you know, this, the rise of its protectors and recognizing the sacred and honoring the sacred and how that's unfolding and how we see more and more people coming into that and recognizing that, yes, this is where I want to be. Waking up sort of out of this automatic trance, if you will, just like the society, you know, this, the way that we are supposed to be, or the stories that we've attached ourselves to, and allowing what really wants to be said and done to move through us. Mm-hmm. We're in this movement right now. It's so powerful and so welcome and so crucial in this moment.
Yeah, it's a very, very potent time to be alive. And there's the extremes are just clashing right now. So it's, you know, I think more than ever, awakening to our wholeness, awakening to our healing, and being seen with our gifts and abilities and speaking out in silence, and being heard is incredibly crucial right now, so that we can lend our voices to the voiceless, to the parts of ourselves and of the world which have been oppressed, ignored, dismissed, or worse. So yeah, I think now more than ever, it's incredibly relevant for us to be activating those places within.
And the dream world is such a, I'm gonna say a mirror in a sense, it's reflecting to us the deeper wisdom. I'm curious, like when you're working with people, how do you see dreams sort of supporting us in trusting our sense of intuition, because I think that a lot of people in the world lost that sense of trust in their own wisdom, what's inside of them. They don't listen, they don't see it, they don't hear it. So how does being present to our dreams awaken our sense of trust in our intuition again?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a big question because I think what happens is, you know, in childhood, most of us develop we inherit a kind of dogma from our families and from our cultures, which say these are the values that we should aggrandize and celebrate, and these other things, you know, are not important, or they're silly, or, you know, or they're just neglected, which often is worse because there's just no frame of reference for those parts of yourself at all. And so a lot of us grow up on a kind of bias with those dogmas. But what happens is at a certain point, we introject those attitudes. In other words, we take it on board. We carry those invalidations as if they are our own. And at this point, it gets really difficult to differentiate between other people's voices and our own voice. And so, for instance, we were speaking about grief before. If we had been taught over and over again that we shouldn't, you know, feel, that we shouldn't have strong feelings, when strong feelings come up for us then as an adult and we have internalized those attitudes, we might be dismissive and abusive towards any feelings that do try and come up. And what you might see then in a dream is a kind of predatory character on your dreamscape. Someone who is, you know, a rapist, or a judge, or a, you know, a Nazi militarized organization, or even just a pursuer. It could be a scary animal or something like this. And so you'll have this kind of predatory influence, which is there just waiting in the forest for the moment where you appear vulnerable to leap on you and violate you. And so you can wake up from these dreams and take them very literally and start, you know, looking around at the people in your life and or starting to wonder about your own psychology. Why am I dreaming of being raped? You know, is there something wrong with me? But the truth is that those dreams are trying to show us what it looks like for the most part. You know, of course there are exceptions, but for the most part, those kinds of dreams are about the violence that we enact upon ourselves. And so learning to make that connection can be incredibly empowering, because, so, you know, when you get one of these dark dreams, it is a validation in and of itself, because that a dream of that darkness would come to the surface means that you are ready to make that peace conscious. You are ready to look at it and to integrate it, right? So if you have one of these predatory dreams, you can now trace back the day before, the day, a couple of days before, and say, so when did I feel violated and attacked? What, you know, and try and make that connection. And it can be a little harder to do by yourself, but it's really great to have somebody who's skilled with things to help walk you through that. And then once you make that connection, oh yeah, I remember I pulled out my paints yesterday, or my journal, or my my project that I was working on. And when I sat down to work on it, I had all these horrible voices which said, you can't do this. You don't know anything. What are you even trying for? Everybody is better than you. You shouldn't even be. What are you wasting your time for? I mean, if that isn't a violation, I don't know what is, right? And so you can begin to make the distinction between that voice, which has come to live on board in your life, but it is from an outside source, versus what is the authentic voice, what is the supportive inner mothering voice, which says, keep going, you're doing great, I stand by you. Or the inner husband, you know, which says, I've got your back, honey, you know, I need you to use your voice louder, brighter, you know, more fabulous. So it can take some practice, but you know, you usually see these dreams in series, right? So you'll see a dream like this, and the form will change, the image will change from dream to dream, but the energy will kind of stay the same. And so a lot of people are on the front lines, a lot of women especially are on the front lines, dethroning their inner tyrants and standing up to their inner bullies and fighting back, you know, not through violence, but through vulnerability, bravery.
I love it. Yes. Oh, what an invitation. What an invitation to recognize, you know, what's here on so many levels. So, you know, for people who don't normally pay attention to their dreams, or I hear also, you know, people say, I can't remember my dreams. Are there some tools or some ways that we can help to just bring them more into our awareness? Or
yeah, absolutely.
Capture our dreams without it. They seem so fleeting. Sometimes you wake up and you jump right into what you want to do for the day, and that dream quickly fades away. How do we hold on to it so we can explore them?
Yeah. Well, I'll give you my top tips.
Yeah, top tips. Awesome.
So the number one thing is maybe the hardest thing. And this thing is making an internal vow to value your dreams. And so this is essential, right? Because your dreams are kind of like lovers. If you don't pay attention to them, and you just ignore them, and you think they're kind of crap, then they're going to, you know, abscond and eventually disappear altogether and wither away, right? But if you love them and shower them in attention and appreciate whatever shows up, then they're going to blossom and show you their most secret, gorgeous insides and love you back. So it is a reciprocity, you know, and it begins with us and valuing our dreams. And of course, there's some very practical ways to do that. The first is, it's really important and fundamental how you wake up. If you are one of those people who wakes up to an alarm clock, you're just never going to have a relationship with your dreams, because alarm clocks kill dreams. They really do. So a lot of people don't know this, but it's really very easy to train your body clock. It's incredibly accurate. So if you're somebody who has to get up at a certain hour, let's say 6 o'clock, that's so early. I hope you don't have to get up at 6 o'clock. But if you do, then you can train your body clock to wake you up at 5:45. And so that way your alarm will still go off if it doesn't work, but it doesn't take much actually to get it to work. You might be amazed by how accurate it is. When you do wake up, you want to remain in the position that you woke up in. So try to keep your body as still as possible. And there's something about moving the body which causes the dreams to be dislodged. So if you can remember to stay in the position you woke up in and to keep your eyes closed. Now,
absolutely felt that, where I've turned in a position and I'm like, I remember that I would actually turn back into the position I was sleeping in and find it again.
Yes. Yeah, that can happen too. So try that if you do forget to stay in the position. The next thing is, you might just have a fragment of a dream if it's just one image. Now, this is a really tricky piece, because most people at this point will dismiss it and say, well, I didn't remember a whole dream, so forget it, you know? That's not an interesting dream. That's not a mythical dream. That was just a boring dream, and I know what it means. All these, your mind, your rational mind plays all of these tricks on you, and you have to penetrate that desire to dismiss. You have to penetrate that dismissal and stay and love the dream you're given. Love the dream you're given. So if you have a fragment, what I want you to do is just honor that fragment and rehearse it in your mind's eye at least three to five times, better on the, to err on the side of five times. And so what I mean by rehearsing is rehearse it from the minute you remember right through to the last thing you remember. And you may find as you do that, new details will emerge. So then the next time you rehearse it, include those details and go from the beginning of what you remember to the end of what you remember. And then do it again, and then do it again. And if you do it five times, then you'll find you'll have quite a solid recall. Now, if all you have is a fragment, it doesn't matter because that's enough. I really need to emphasize this strongly. A lot of people will say, well, all I had was a fragment, and so it's not really anything to work with. But I'll tell you, those fragment dreams are some of the most powerful dreams I have ever encountered. Often when you have dreams with a lot of detail and a lot of subplots, those dreams can be can make your attention very diffuse because there's so much you don't know where to focus. Whereas with a fragment, it almost has a holographic quality to it, in that in this single image, an entirety can be contained at a level of depth. So you can go very deep with a single image. And so then you have to write them down. And this is the thing, dreams love being written down. I don't know what it is. I think it has to do with being honored through materialization. Right? Like, it's like giving relevance to it by writing it down. But even if you just have a fragment, you have to write it down. And what will happen is the next night you'll have more dreams, and the next night you'll have more dreams. So, and these things go in ebbs and cycles too, ebbs and flows. So, even people who have a solid relationship with their dreams will go through what we call dream droughts. And that's usually because you're too busy and you've got too many things going on during the day and your focus is on the outer world. And so that's why winter is such a great time for dreaming, because it's a less extroverted time and we're more internal. So if you are in a dream drought, notice that maybe there's a little too much yang focus in your life and you need a little more yin, receptive, fill your well kind of time. And then more dreams will come back with that. And again, you come back to the fragment, even just start there, and they'll grow from there. And as long as you're in that practice, you'll be having dreams.
Yeah. And you know, I'm curious, I've actually done a little bit of dream work before with someone who was working with me, and they had me recall, when I recall a dream, it would be in present time.
Yes.
Oh, I did this. I'm walking. Like, you're in the dream. What do you see? What are the details? When we're writing it down, do you recommend writing it in the present experience?
I do. Yeah. Always write it in present tense. And the other thing you can do is to give your dream a title. Similar to writing a headline for a news story, the title can actually be a really important part of the process. What I usually do is write the dream first and then give it a title afterwards, because as I've written the dream, I'll tune into what this, because you kind of want to capture what is the central image. And in a way, the title acts as a mini interpretation. Similar to a news story, if you're just scanning through newspaper, you see a headline, you pretty much know what the story is without any of the details, just by looking at it. And the benefit of that too is when you're reflecting on your journal and looking at older dreams, you'll be able to zero right in through the title to what your dream is. To which dream you're looking for.
And then looking at patterns that keep coming up when you're, as you're keeping that dream journal, are you looking, you're looking for those patterns?
Yeah. Yeah. Looking for patterns is, I would say that's more of an intermediate practice. But of course it's essential. It's better to work with a series of dreams than it is to just work with one. So a lot of people, I have a private practice, and people come to me from all over the world, and we work on Skype with their dreams. And I prefer to work with people for longer periods of time, because if you just do like a one-off dream, it can be valuable. It can be very powerful and valuable, but you want to see how then your dream maker responds to the work that you've done. And it becomes a kind of living conversation with the unseen world.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have this dream school that you created.
So I do.
Tell us about that. What kind of classes are in this dream school? What would people experience being with you in that?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I do lots of in the body workshops and retreats. And so I go when people invite me, like I was just invited. I'll be giving a retreat in Wisconsin actually in March. So it's a dreaming retreat, which takes place Friday night. I actually don't know the dates. We'll be announcing it tomorrow or the day after. And so it'll be a 3-day dreaming retreat. And I give a retreat annually here on Salt Spring Island. And that happens in October of 2017. And that's a longer form one. We go for 4 or 5 days, and it's a place of reunion too. So people come back year after year to be with each other and to be deepening into that sense of living as a dreaming ecosystem together. So that's a women's retreat. And then I also teach online. So I have a course which is called Dream Walking, and I actually have one coming up in January, and then again in, I think, April or May. I'm not certain about those dates, but you can just visit my website to check out what workshops and events are coming up, which is tokopa.com, tokopa.com. But yeah, so dream walking
we're gonna have a link. We'll have a link right there. You guys can click on it to go check out her website. Yeah.
Awesome. So dream walking is a 4-week course, and it's good for beginning and intermediate dreamers. And I have 4 modules, and they basically, it's me talking to you on video, similar to this, about what I think are the cornerstones of dream work. So learning mostly how to work with your own dreams, but also just learning about dreams, the language of dreams, the art of trying to understand the language of dreams, learning how to reconcile paradox and the opposites within. And then also some of the more mystical practices like lucid dreaming, becoming awake within your dream and using dreaming as a spiritual practice. So it's a big sort of overview course. We work on shadow dreams. We spend a whole week working on shadow dreams, working with shadow material, how to interpret that shadow.
Diving into the shadow in the dreams.
What's that?
What does that look like? The shadow dreams.
Well, shadow dreams can be anything from a dream that is filled with anxiety to actually encountering a threatening figure like we were talking about before. So anything that you would classify as a nightmare.
Yeah, so we're showing something that we don't know about ourselves, that we're hiding behind in our shadow.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. So we talk about how the shadow develops, and then how to begin to unpack that, what Robert Bly calls the long black bag we drag behind us. Yes. So in other words, bringing those things which have been neglected, ignored, not yet discovered, or dismissed from our lives, how to bring them back into belonging in our lives. And so this is, it's a wonderfully powerful set of teachings where we're actually learning to more or less turn and face that which we haven't been looking at. People move psychic mountains in this work. It's incredible.
The great invitation of our time right now is the great turning toward ourselves, all that's alive inside of us, turning toward each other, turning toward our world. So that it feels like dream work in general is shadow work in a lot of ways.
I guess for me it's more than that, because unless you want to define the shadow as also containing our gold, because I do sort of define it that way, you know. I think a huge percentage of what's in the shadows is something that could be integrated and assimilated to become allyship to us. But there's a lot of medicine that comes through our dreams, which is not just about looking at what's unseen, but it comes from divine places. You know, it's transmitted in our dreams. So there's a great deal more than shadow, I think, to be found there.
Yeah, the deeper wisdom of our world that we all share. As we were saying earlier, you know, that collective, the collective message, the message for the whole. And as you were sharing in dream work, when you're working with groups, that these symbols are coming that are, right? That people are sharing the symbolism. And so there's definitely a deeper wisdom that's appearing through our dreams.
Absolutely. Which is why it's taking me such a long time to write this book, you know, because I can only go at the pace at which it's being it's being delivered to me. I think we all, you know, it's like there's this, it's been said that the unconscious is really like the Akashic records, the appendix of our entire species and perhaps beyond our species, which exists, you know, in this place that we all have a secret portal to, a secret gateway to access. So, I mean, the hugeness of beauty and inexhaustible wisdom and creativity that comes through our dreams is staggering, really, which is why I'm just endlessly fascinated with it.
Absolutely. It is. It's so rich. The landscape of our dreams is so rich. There's just so much there. And I'm so happy to have you here being able to talk about this in such a beautiful poetic way, you know, so eloquent, because we do need to pay attention to what's inside of us. Our landscape is such that mirror, that window into ourselves on those levels where nothing can really penetrate that deeper wisdom that wants to come through. Such a pure way of looking at ourselves.
And I think it has an overall sensitizing effect on us. You know, as we were talking about earlier, it kind of makes us increasingly porous to the other kinds of conversations that are taking place outside the human-centric realm. And I think more than ever, you know, that sort of ecological aptitude, for lack of a better word, a kind of the conversational nature of being in this world is like, that's something we really need to be strengthening right now, because we've really become so disconnected and we think mainly about ourselves and about our little culture that we've built, a lot of smoke and mirrors within it. But I think there is this deep longing at the heart of so many people right now to be part of something greater, to feel a connection to our own wilderness within and to that greater wilderness which surrounds us. And to be in conversation, you know, to be in a kind of shamanic conversation with it so that we can have a sense of purpose in the way that we walk and that there's a meaningfulness to it now. And I think dream work really sensitizes us to that other than human world, which right now has been so denigrated and is really on this precipice of devastating collapse. And anything we can do to sensitize ourselves to its needs in our local environments, I think is so connected to the depression and anxiety that we feel in our own lives. And if we can strengthen that relationship a bit more, it makes a lot of things make sense.
Absolutely. I mean, there's nothing that's happening outside of us that isn't also happening within us. We feel everything. It's all interconnected.
Yes.
Yeah, so beautifully said. Yeah, it is a really pivotal moment. You know, this feels more crucial than ever to engage in that deeper conversation and to pay attention to the subtleties that are happening inside of us and, you know, the ways that we relate and who I am in relation to you and who I am in relation to the world and who we are in relation to this unfolding moment in time, like all of it,
Yeah, and to the ancestral momentum which produced the likes of us in present time, you know.
Yeah, and to ourselves as we become those ancestors for the future ones. All of it here, all of it.
Yeah.
So beautiful. So I'm really excited about your book that's coming out, and you know, this it brings us all back to that sense of belonging, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm excited to share some of these ideas with the world, and writing a book is a really big undertaking, and I had no idea what I was getting myself into. It's my first book, and I'm putting a lot of myself into it, so I'm really excited to share it, and just to open up that conversation to in a little broader way. To you know, how we can start to really ask those questions about what, you know, when we don't feel like we belong, when we feel outside of some inner circle, how does it motivate us to act? How does it drive us? How does that lack of belonging drive us in ways that may not be healthy for our own lives and for the world around us too? Because when you feel a sense of not belonging, often it creates a very strong drive to achieve or to improve yourself or to, you know, create something out of scratch.
Yes, yes.
You know, that can somehow stand for your worthiness. And so healing some of that is going to be really essential to a lot of us allowing ourselves to kind of sink back into the absolute enoughness, which is who we are in present time, you know. And from that place, when we create from that place, our creativity then becomes a kind of generosity rather than a hunger.
Yeah, absolutely. And we recognize within that our sacred service in the world.
Yes, yeah.
So perfect, so beautiful. And I love, you know, this conversation of how dreams really serve us in our inner knowing and in our personal transformation and our stepping into ourselves more fully, more wholly, more completely, because we're always that, we're always here. And this is just a great reminder.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, for anyone who's had a relationship with their dreams and then maybe in a dream drought or has somehow become disconnected from them, you know what a huge grief can come up about that. Because if you've had a relationship with your dreams, you have experienced that deep sense of being guided by something greater. And so when that thing is lost, it's really felt as lost, because then you're just kind of making decisions from your mind, you know, which is fine. And it you can function a long time that way. In fact, most of our world is built on that kind of functioning.
Yeah. But in our world right now, we can see where that's getting us. So tapping back into the soul, you know, of who we are. Yeah,
exactly. And allowing yourselves to be guided by that deeper something. So just know, if you're out there listening and you, you know, are feeling that grief of being disconnected from your dreams, it really takes so very little. It takes so little. You can literally get your dreams back in a week or two. And I guarantee you that, you know, I've had people say, oh, I haven't remembered my dreams for 10 years. And they have grief about it, because of course, that's a long time to not have any dreams. And then I tell them, you know, don't worry, you're just do these few simple steps that I was sharing with you earlier and you'll get your dreams back. And they'll come to me the next day and be like, I had a great dream. So it's really not, I mean, it's just a matter of valuing it and learning to become approachable by mystery, learning to become welcoming, having that beginner's mind and allowing ourselves to receive from those realms. So, and I'm happy to, if anybody would like to work on some dreams, if you do have dreams and you don't know what to do with them, please feel free to contact me, and you can actually set up an appointment with me right through my website if you want to do some dream work together. Or you can join one of the online courses or come to a retreat and meet some of the other amazing beings who are attracted to this work, because the other beautiful thing is that when dreamers come into circle together, then they realize a sense of really belonging together, which is sustainable, you know.
Beautiful, Beautiful dreamers. Okay, so everyone, tonight you're going to grab your dream journal and you're going to place it next to your bed and follow those beautiful tips to harness the dream when you awaken, be in that position, repeat the dream over and over, find that, even if it's just that one little moment, just stay with it and rehearse it over and over, and then very subtly have your pen, don't move much, start writing it down in present tense and give it a title. Did I miss anything?
You are an A+ student, gold stars.
Awesome. So that's our beautiful invitation tonight, our dream work. I love it. Tokopa, thank you so much
for bringing us to the world
and holding the space for us to dive in.
You're so welcome. Thank you for spearheading this amazing event and for bringing all these people together. I hope people receive a huge amount of wisdom from it. I know they will. And thank you for all of the energy of your life force that it has taken to pull all of this together. I know what a big job it is.
Yes, and it's really my pleasure and my service, because I know we need to deepen this conversation right now in all the beautiful ways and all the beautiful language that we all do it in.
Right, and so we have, and so we will.
Thank you so much, Esther.
Thank you.